Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 158 for July 29th, 2011. This will be the last episode that I will be recording in Cambridge, Massachusetts for a while because Darlene and I are headed to Ocean Park, Maine on Sunday for our annual sojourn by the sea. I'll see if I can record some new sounds of surf for your listening pleasure once we get up there for the next week's show. For this week's interview, I consulted a long list of possible guests that I keep in Evernote, and I found a link to a Wall Street Journal column written in October 2009 that, as it turns out, foretold much of what has transpired in the ebook revolution since then. This made me eager to speak with the author, Stephen Marsh, who is an Esquire columnist and a thoughtful champion of the Kindle.
We're really, really at the beginning of this. And I think when we look back 10 years from now or, 20 years from now, it'll be, you saying to me, oh my goodness, you can keep 3,000 books in your Kindle will seem like a terrible joke.
There was quite a bit of news this week. Amazon released an earnings report for the quarter, and a battle between Apple and Amazon sort of faded away with a whimper. And I'm also going to talk to you about a new case, which I received a review copy of, that will have some particular advantages for possibly for the use of your Kindle on vacation. For the tech tip, I'm going to take a look at the new feature of the Kindle for iPad app, which enables you to load archived copies of a magazine or newspaper onto your iPad. I ran into some troubles with it. We'll see what's up. And in content, I'm going to highlight a new way that you can submit a Kindle single manuscript for review. Before I get to the earnings report, I'm going to tell you about an article which came out a week ago on July 22nd in Information Week. It was posted by Gina Smith, Eric, and Eric Mack, titled Amazon's Upcoming Tablet to be Wi-Fi Contract Free. This article quotes another analyst at Forrester Research, Frank Gillett. That's not someone I spoke to. Usually I'm talking with James McQuivey from Forrester. But Mr. Gillett says, if I connect all the dots, where I think Amazon is headed is towards something like Apple's cloud. This is what he told Byte. He's also predicting the effort will include some new services from Amazon, like email, as the company moves to help consumers manage not only the commercial content that it sells, but also personal content. The tablet is rumored to ship in a 9-inch form factor. WhisperSync essentially turns the future tablet, or a Kindle, into a Wi-Fi free cell device that uses cloud drive to share and sync huge volumes of rich media, including books, music, photos, and video. This is what sources are telling Byte. But you just end up thinking that this is a device that is constantly connected. I don't have to worry about Wi-Fi, and I don't have to pay for it. I had some fun with an Amazon Kindle tech support person today because I've wanted to experiment with the free video streaming that is available for a Prime membership on Amazon, but for some reason our Prime membership has got Darlene listed as the primary member, and I'm listed as a guest. So when I tried to start playing around with this, it said, sorry Charlie, you're only a guest. And when I called and said, could I switch it around, they said, well, not really, and I'm going to have to wait till that expires and then put a new one in my name. But I had been confused, and I thought that I was able to stream on the iPad, and the tech guy said, well, I got some bad news. You can't do that because the streaming requires Flash. And it immediately made me think of the tablet. I'm sure the tablet's going to have Flash. I asked the guy if he could confirm that when the Amazon tablet comes out, I'll be able to do this free streaming via Flash from my Prime account. And he said, well, I read the same news reports that you do. If he knew anything, he wasn't saying. This is pretty fun stuff, though. When I'm putting the podcast together, I always go through a period of some procrastination, probably duplicating my experience in a newsroom where everything sort of comes together at the deadline. And I found a great new way to procrastinate on Friday or whenever I'm putting the podcast together, because I found by logging into Darlene's Amazon account on my computer, I was able to check out some of the new material that Amazon is making available for free. And guess what?
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship.
You can get the first season of Gilligan's Island. And so I started watching the first episode of the first season of Gilligan's Island on the Amazon streaming, and it was hilarious. I mean, it's black and white, and it's just as goofy as it can be. It brings back all my memories of watching that crazy show. And the first episode is about when they first land on the island, and they're making a raft, and it's crazy. So I wasted some happy time on that, getting ready to get serious about putting the podcast together. But
and the rest are here.
You know, a tablet comes, there's rumors that if you're a Prime member, or you're the primary Prime member, you'll be able to log on with your tablet and just sit in your chair and watch Gilligan's Island or some, you know, movies or whatever else they put up there, and not be paying any kind of a Netflix fee or anything like that. That'd be pretty sweet. Never mind all the music and the books and the rest of it. You know, this is a Kindle story in that the Kindle book content is certainly going to be a factor on the tablet. But I think, as I've said before, I'm glad to hear that there's rumors of actual new Kindles coming out. And I'm hoping that in the next few months there's going to be a lot to talk about, with maybe two new Kindles and one new tablet. And I think that this think piece, I'll have a link to it in the show notes for you, from Information Week about how Amazon ties all this together using WhisperSync and, you know, maybe expanding the reach of the 3G in ways that really give it an advantage over Apple, which isn't offering anything like that. You've got to be on Wi-Fi or buying a separate 3G contract on the iPad to get that kind of service. Let's take a look now at the earnings. I'll go with John Cogg at Beyond Black Friday for an account of the earnings, because I know he follows the reports pretty carefully, as does Stephen Windwalker and a number of others. But John's blog piece on July 26 was titled "Surprises in Amazon's New Quarterly Report?" The big news was that Amazon announced that for the 3 months, April through June, they surprised Wall Street's analysts, particularly in the sales. Amazon's net sales for the period were 51% higher than the year-ago quarter. And Jeff Bezos said it was the fastest growth they've seen in over a decade. Kindle 3G with special offers has quickly become our best-selling Kindle at only $139, Bezos continued. And he's touting the convenience of not having to hunt for Wi-Fi. John notes that Bezos insisted that Amazon sales growth was being driven by low prices, expanding selection, fast delivery, and innovation. And it's not all about the Kindles, and they never actually say how many Kindles have been sold. Fortunately, John says, Bloomberg News talked to an industry analyst instead, who estimated that Amazon may have sold more than 8 million Kindles, and that's last year, and they estimate that Kindle readers already account for 5% of Amazon's total sales. Amazon is now approaching the 1 million ebooks available at the Kindle store. I thought they had passed that mark. It seemed like I saw something in Bufo Calvin's blog, but maybe it goes up and it goes down, because I don't think it's showing the million title mark at this point. Sales of Kindle and electronic merchandise are two big drivers for Amazon, and this is what an analyst told Bloomberg News. And despite some pressure from costs, Amazon is running on all cylinders. The profits were actually down some, and that's because they're investing in the business. John was surprised to learn that more than 45% of Amazon's sales weren't even in North America. Amazon also has sites for Japan, China, France, England, Germany, and Italy. Amazon's total sales for just the last 3 months were $9.9 billion. And investors seemed impressed after the stock market close. Late trading pushed the company's shares up a full 6.9%. So a good quarter with obviously the Kindle continuing to play a role. And as usual, no real hard data on Kindle sales that were announced with the quarterly earnings. For quite a while now, there's been discussion of how Apple was playing rough with people like Amazon who were selling through their Apple app. In this case, it would be the Kindle for the iPad and the other iOS devices. And they were changing things so that you weren't going to be able to buy things through the Kindle app on the iPad. Big rumble coming, and we all spent some time analyzing it, thinking about it. In the event it happened that basically Amazon blinked, took the buy button down. I kind of liked how Stephen Windwalker covered this. He actually didn't cover it. He conducted an experiment in a blog post on July 28th. Stephen wrote, "We thought we would see what would happen if we didn't have anything to say about it. More of those kinds of news items appear these days on our BookGorilla.com sister blog anyway, so we didn't feel we'd be letting you down by saying mum. Why?" And he just says this kind of thing gets a lot of attention from tech bloggers and partisans, but he was curious to see if the change really mattered to anyone among the thousands of serious readers who visit Kindle Nation every day. He says, "The results are in. We didn't receive a single email, blog comment, tweet, or Facebook comment or message about the change." I don't want to claim that I told you so on this, but I always did think that it was going to be pretty easy to buy Kindle books on my iPad, even if I wasn't able to go directly through the Kindle app to do it. And that's what Amazon has been announcing when they informed us that the new Kindle app, and you would get it updated at the App Store on your device just like the others, was not going to enable the purchase of books through it. But all you had to do is make a bookmark in Safari and go there, and you can buy a book and you can download it to your iPad and read it on your iPad, and so everything else is pretty much the same. There are also some changes on how you can put content from your archives if you're subscribing to magazines and newspapers. Some of them are enabling you now to put single issues from your archive onto your iPad, and I think other iOS devices and other Kindle apps. I'm going to talk in the tech tip about this because I had some trouble actually trying to do that, but it's a nice additional feature of the Kindle app, so that they had some good news to balance the, as it turns out, not that big a deal of not being able to buy the books within the app. Lastly, I want to talk about a Kindle case. The company sent me a review copy. It's a clear case. It's a clear plastic case for $49. And the company started out with a case for the Kindle 2. It's a pretty clever item because it totally matches the design of the specific model. And I tried out the Kindle 2 one, I remember, last summer. You can't go surfing with it the way I did with the Guardian case from M-Edge. I made a video of that was sort of fun. But it protects from the sand, and if there's a little splashing going on, it's going to give your Kindle some protection. I thought the design of this new case for the Kindle 3 was better than the one last year for the Kindle 2, because on the last year you had to do some sort of tricky sliding of about, I think there's maybe six plastic pieces that you had to slide into place to bring the two, the front and the back of the cover together. And in this new version, there's no separate sliding pieces. You just sort of snap fasteners that are part of the front and the back together. So there's only two pieces to this thing, as opposed to those extra slider pieces. I found the assembly of it really quite easy. And the controls, once you've got it nestled in there, there's kind of a soft area that you can control the keypad on your Kindle 3, and you have access to all the buttons. Everything seems to work quite well. The only drawback I saw to it is, actually, I did try it out up in Maine last weekend when we were there. The part of the case that covers the keypad is it's kind of spongy, or, you know, it has to be so that you can press through it to hit the keys, and it actually, the sand kind of sticks to it. So if you get a little sand on that part of it as opposed to the very smooth plastic part that's over the screen, you're going to have a little difficulty cleaning it off, and that's, you know, a very minor drawback, I'd say, to the design of it. I'll have a link to it in the show notes to check it out. It's a clear case with a K, and looks like they've done a nice job making a case in time for summer use for the Kindle 3, and I'm sure they'll be setting their designers to work if we do get two new Kindles coming, perhaps maybe in September or something like that. If you want to go direct to the website to check out this cover, it's clear case with a K, K-L-E-A-R-C-A-S-E.com, and that cover is available for $49.99. And that includes free shipping. For the tech tip, I'm going to follow up on my mention of the new Kindle for iPad, iPhone, iOS. That would also include the iPod Touch. I ran into some difficulty taking advantage of the new ability to move an individual copy of a magazine or a newspaper from my archive to my iPad. And I called Kindle support tonight to see if I could get some help on it. And it was a bit mysterious, because when I would go to manage your Kindle and then I'd see my subscriptions, there's a button that now appears, and that gives you an action to download a specific issue of magazine or newspaper into a device. Now, I could see that this was available as something I could do for Newsweek, New York Review of Books, and the New York Times. But the problem was, when the drop-down list of devices showed up, it only showed my Kindle with special, Kindle 3G with special offers, and my original Kindle, and the iPad was grayed out along with the other apps. Weirdly, when I brought this to the attention of the rep, she said, well, let me work on it, and she was, I held for quite a while, and when she came back, she said, well, I just simply kept trying it, and then I noticed that eventually the iPad app was not grayed out, so I was able to send a couple of the items to your iPad, and sure enough, the Newsweek and the New York Review of Books showed up on the iPad. It's a cool new feature of the iOS apps, and I'd be curious to hear how it's going. If you've tried it, moving some content from your archive, you can send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. Stephen Marsh, who lives in Toronto, is a columnist for Esquire and the author of How Shakespeare Changed Everything, as well as several well-received novels. In October of 2009, he wrote a column which appeared in the Wall Street Journal under the title The Book That Contains All Books. The globally available Kindle could mark as big a shift for reading as the printing press and the codex. I spoke with Stephen by Skype on Tuesday, July 26th, and I began by asking him how he came to write that article, which now seems a bit prophetic.
I was a relatively early adopter of Kindle. I mean, I'm not an early adopter of almost anything, any other form of technology. But I do love e-readers, and at that point the Kindle was way out ahead. I mean, it was so much better than the competition that it was basically a completely different entity.
Now, did you have the original Kindle when it came out?
No, I got the Kindle 2 when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I realized once I had it that, you know, the moment I had it, I knew that it was going to change reading. And I also knew that, you know, despite what my friends told me, that the iPad was not going to replace e-readers at all.
Why is that?
Well, it was the screen, but also it was a basic misunderstanding of what reading was. You know, because, and I still believe this idea that books are going to have little videos in them and so on. That's China Mieville, is that how you pronounce that writer? I mean, he said that that's a category error, and that's exactly what I think it is. People want books that can swallow them up. And you know, the iPad is more of a tool for distraction, whereas a Kindle is something that sucks you up.
And that's because the process of reading text swallows you up in a way that watching video doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, text is a engaged medium, right? I mean, it requires concentration and thought, whereas video does not. And you know, that is the basic difference between reading and not reading. And that difference isn't going to change it.
Well, and I've thought about this a lot. One counter to that argument, which I've wondered about, is if you have a book that lets you move to a video, or all of a sudden you're doing an audio, or you have all these different options, doesn't that opportunity for choosing what you're going to be looking at and experiencing, doesn't that increase the level of engagement as opposed to just sitting passively and taking in the words that the author wrote?
Well, I think taking in the words that the author wrote is not a passive experience. That's the difference. I mean, when you read something, you engage with it, you have to concentrate on it, you have to kind of create it yourself as you go along, whereas text and audio are passive. And I mean, that's why I don't think it'll ever really meld, because one, the experiences of them are just so jarringly different. You know, maybe I could be wrong, but I have to say the ones that I've seen so far have not really convinced me. I mean, it just makes it seem distracting.
Yeah.
You know, and you just tend to go into even when you're looking at something like The Onion online, you know, when you go to the text, you sort of get lost in the labyrinth of the texts there. But when you watch video, you just watch video. I don't find you go back and forth a lot.
Do you think that young people are going to continue in this tradition of the engagement with text? It seems like sometimes you hear kids talk, it's video games, it's movies, that reading is some kind of a retroactivity that they're just not into.
Well, I don't think any medium dies. You know, I mean, I think it's, you know, radio is still really popular. Mm-hmm. Radio should have died with the advent of television. But, you know, it doesn't. You know, it didn't. And millions of people still listen to the radio. And reading isn't going anywhere. I think, you know, kind of the opposite. I mean, to me, the internet is a reader's medium, primarily. Mm. I mean, you can watch TV on it. But when people, you know, when people go to Twitter, when people go to, you know, when people go online, for the most part, they're reading a lot of text. And I think that's amazingly exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Now, one of the points that fascinated me about that article from 2009 was when you're talking about the shift from the scroll to bound pages, the codex,
yeah.
And comparing that to the current shift from the traditional book to the Kindle or the e-reader. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was this very fascinating shift in about the 4th century AD from scrolls to codexes, which you know, basically created the Gospels and created, you know, a lot of other important books. You know, basically it went from a work of literature being a gift that you would give someone, like a single object, which you would give to a friend, like you would give them a painting or something mm-hmm. like that, to basically small libraries. And this created an urbanity around books that it didn't really have before, a way of fusing together contradictory voices, I mean, literally binding them together. And I think what we're seeing with the Kindle right now is the sort of early stages of that, the early beginnings of text being folded together in ways that they never have been before.
Well, and it's a fascinating comparison, because now you can have your whole library, 3,000 books in this one device.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the problem with the Kindle, the problem with talking about the Kindle is how primitive things are, right? I mean, we're really, really at the beginning of this. Mm. And I think when we look back 10 years from now, or, you know, 20 years from now, it'll be, you know, you saying to me, oh my goodness, you can keep 3,000 books in your Kindle will yeah. seem like a terrible joke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see absolutely no reason why you shouldn't have all books on your Kindle.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the inevitable result that this is going to, is that, you know, it'll be like Spotify or something like that, where you'll pay a monthly fee and you just have access to the world's literature
yeah.
on device.
Well, and that's Amazon's stated mission, to have every book ever printed available in 60 seconds.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, the thing is, that's an achievable goal.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not fantasy. That's not science fiction. That's really, really possible. And you know, also we don't really know, like, the paratext around the Kindle, the paratext around e-readers hasn't really been developed yet. It hasn't really been thought through, and the way that it's been thought through has been quite, it just hasn't gelled yet. It takes some time to do that.
What do you mean by paratext?
Well, I mean, for example, to take in, when you got the early codexes, there are things like, what are their names? They're leaders at the bottom of text, so that when you get to the bottom of a page, a single word from the top of the next page will be at the bottom, and then you just, so your eye can just go more fluidly. And that was developed for people used to reading on scrolls,
right,
so that they could then could do this continuous reading. The page movement, which of course is still, you know, I think the new Kobo has 6 pages that get loaded at once.
Mm-hmm.
So can, you know, with, so you don't get that little flashback.
Yep.
I mean, that's a lead up, but obviously that's going to go away. The things we need to do are like skimming, for instance. We need to figure out a way to skim text. You know, in the Middle Ages and in the early part of the Renaissance, it was quite common for nonfiction books to have marginalia all the way through that was little precis of the argument in each paragraph.
Hmm.
So you didn't have to read the whole book if you didn't want to. You could go along the side and find out what the argument was and just skim through it. Particularly useful for big histories and things like that. And we don't have. There's no reason why that shouldn't be there. That there shouldn't be a skimmer's guide to every book.
Exactly.
You know. Also, I think things like, you know, the way that commentaries work. You know, it's being worked out, but the possibilities are really immense. I mean, and have been barely touched. I mean, you should be able to get, you know, professors at universities in the humanities should be working out elaborate and free commentaries on every single source of important literature out there. I mean, you should be able to get free a commentary on The Great Gatsby produced by 15 Harvard, you know, 15 Princeton professors. And, you know, and that should just be, you know, that's an automatic. I mean, that's a given that sort of thing will come. You know, how this is all to be paid for, of course, is a different matter to be worked out later. But my point is really that, and those are only the ones that I've thought of as sort of my, you know, my little thoughts. You know, there's so much farther we can go with this technology and with the way that text can be given. You know, I think it's incredibly exciting.
Yeah, well, the public highlights thing is already there.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading Gutenberg Galaxy, the McLuhan book, and all of a sudden there was a highlighted passage by a guy named Craig Maud, who's, I guess, kind of a thinker on books and typography and stuff like that. And it sort of sent a chill up my spine, because all of a sudden it was as if I was reading this book with this guy.
Yeah.
And he, well, unfortunately hadn't left any notes, but that would have been even cooler.
Well, see, that and that's possible to do now. I mean, that came out, I think, 6 months ago around
yeah.
there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think, you know, that shouldn't just be for tech guys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the professors should get off their behinds and start doing this.
Yeah.
Start preparing the commentaries, because it would be very useful. You know, and it would be like the library is now changing. The library now will be accessible anywhere. And so it need, you know, the hard lifting of getting the library in good order, which it really is not at all now. I don't think it can be done just by private companies. I mean, I think it has to be, it never has in the past. I mean, whenever one of these technological leaps has happened and it's required, you know, there's been a requirement to build the new centers of knowledge, that's always been a mass work that requires the effort of millions.
Yep.
You know, I think the whole notion of the library, eventually it will be magnificently wonderful, but we're in such early days now. I mean, you know, think about the fonts issue. Like, even you can't really even get multiple fonts on Kindle unless you break it, right? Unless you hack it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just ridiculous. You know, I mean, you should be able to buy, you know, fonts changed with Gutenberg. Gutenberg decided that you needed a whole new set of fonts for print. You know, we should have access to the hundreds of brilliant typographers who are out there making typography that for some reason we can't use.
Yeah.
Why can't you buy that for 30 cents, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, how about the divide between reading as a strictly solitary activity, which is sort of how we've grown up with the book so far, and these more social aspects where now I can highlight a passage and bump it up to my Twitter or my Facebook feed, or these public highlights. to where it's more social. Is that something which detracts from kind of the essence of what reading is about, or simply enhances it?
Well, the primacy of reading, of course, is, you know, it's one of those things that we regard as inevitable. I mean, I cherish the privacy of reading. I don't want to pretend that that is anything other than sacred, but that's not going away. You know, the possibility of doing that is not going away. What is new is that there's a chance to do new stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very exciting. And also, not as newfangled as you think. I mean, there's a famous passage in St. Augustine's Confessions where he talks about St. Anselm. It's another saint. I'm not sure of the saint. And he's amazed at this saint because he can read without speaking out loud. You know, that he can, because he can read to himself. And he finds this absolutely incredible. You know, that change to private reading, you know, it was not always the case that reading was a private matter.
Right.
So I think the socialization of reading is perfectly natural. It also, you know, that is why we have libraries. That is why we have, academies to provide us with, socialized reading.
Book clubs.
Yeah, marketing. I mean, what do you think publishers want?
In your 2009 article, you were talking about how the Codex was one of the keys to the nation power of Christianity in the late Roman period, because it concentrated the cultural power that a sizable library embodied. Do you have any kind of a hint? I mean, we've got now another incredible concentration of the cultural power of a library. Mm. Is there a religion that's going to benefit, or a sector of culture that takes advantage of that compression the way Christianity did in the late Roman period?
That's a very profound question. I mean, wow, I don't really know. I guess maybe it's my optimism, but I think who's going to benefit from it is secular humanists. I mean, I think the concentration of power in these, you know, the thing is, it just allows the dissemination of information to be sort of complete and utter. And, the primary mode that, you know, what they're disseminating so far is secular literature. You know, I mean, that is just as the first thing that the Codex was were the Gospels and religious texts. I mean, what's being sent out here, what the library that's being prepared, is the ultimate secular library. So, you know, ultimately, while that question is sort of inherently unanswerable, I would say that it's secularity, or, you know, I guess, you know, to be more totally accurate, like the neo-paganism of the 21st century. I mean, I think one thing that's very interesting about the Kindle and the e-reader in general, we were talking about McLuhan earlier, is that it's a cool medium, you know, and its rise is not, it is the first medium that has arisen in a long time that is cold, that requires engagement rather than passivity. And, you know, McLuhan never predicted that. I mean, he thought, you know, his famous quote about how he went to professors and he thought that, you know, that their values were burning down, and he wanted to tell them that their house was burning down. This is kind of a way is the house being built back up. I think, you know, because it is such an, you know, such a wonderful testament to the power of reading.
Yeah, it increases. It's a new portal for engagement, because you can do that engaged reading so much more efficiently and powerfully with this device.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, once you use it, it's very hard to go back to a bookstore.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's what I find anyway. I mean, you don't even know if the bookstore has the book you're looking for. As I said, you know, we're in such early days now that I don't think anyone really knows what the harvest will be, because we don't really know what the consequences of having no border to texts, like no effort to get to text.
Yeah.
Because that's ultimately what it's getting to. You know, very small price for instant access to all literature with elaborate commentaries. I mean, you know, whether that takes 20 years, whether it takes 50 years, who owns that information is a separate matter. But, you know, ultimately that's where it's going. And I think we don't really know what the consequences of that will be. Whether it'll be a democratization of books or a new elitism, you know, it's very hard to say. But, you know, I think one thing that's very clear is that, you know, and that the e-reader shows is that reading isn't going anywhere, you know? I mean, it isn't going anywhere at all.
And that's probably, I mean, you have said that you think the Kindle is such good news for writers. Is that part of it? I mean, if you're a writer and reading is on the rise, that's good news.
Well, I guess it depends what you're talking about. I mean, it's sort of like what's happened to music is ultimately going to happen to books, right? I mean, you know, and what happened to books and, you know, is like Sony, they got screwed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they also weren't really engaged. You know, they decided to resist it with their whole heart. I think for, you know, writers who are very naturally very conservative, I don't think they've really recognized what an amazing opportunity this is, you know, and what, especially for, you know, there are certain things that haven't, like the Amazon singles is a step, you know, a step in the right direction, but the length of books has really been determined so far by print.
Yeah.
By the materiality of print. I hope that there will be an explosion of novellas and also really short nonfiction books. Because I think readers love them. I really do believe, but they, you know, they didn't make financial sense when it was print, but with, you know, with an e-reader, it makes no difference.
Yeah, and you've got the whole timeliness of it. You know, I talked to a guy that edited a book that Foreign Policy magazine put out about the tsunami and earthquake, and he said, "Well, I thought I would do an academic press, but that would have been at least a year." And
yeah.
With this, he sent it off to them, and within a month, it was available at the Kindle store, and all the proceeds were going to benefit survivors of the quake. So the ability to jump on an event with a really diverse group of authors and a thoughtful approach is totally new.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's super exciting. I think the line between a magazine piece and a nonfiction book is going to decrease until... There may be no line at all.
There was a kind of a snarky piece in the Wall Street Journal a while back that was bemoaning the demise of the gatekeepers in traditional publishing, that saying that readers were going to end up missing these people that plowed through the slush pile and, you know, panning for gold and finding the few things that are worth reading. And now essentially we as readers are going to have access to the slush pile and we're going to have to do all that work. What do you make of that worry?
I think it's greatly optimistic to say that the Kindle is going to do away with publishing. I mean, if it got rid of the gatekeepers, God, I'd be so happy. But the truth is, it isn't. Because, you know, I mean, I don't know. I just haven't really seen any writers who have burst onto the scene yet on their own. You know, I mean, who just have done it like, you know what, I'm going to put out an ebook and I'm going to market myself and I'm going to do this sort of thing. Like, the truth, they're out there, but they're so rare. It takes a very rare kind of human being to be able to do that.
You get the Amanda Hawking and J.A. Conrad. So they're sort of the exceptions that prove the rule.
Yeah. Also, you know, are they really writing literary fiction? You know, I think, like, I'm not sure the gatekeeper was talking about. You know, I'm not sure in that article like, the guy was talking about that specific kind of gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't know. Like, the 25-year-old writers who are in the New Yorker 20 under 40, mm-hmm. you know, they need publishers. They need people who can tell them how to do this and how to get things out there. And I actually don't think publishers are going anywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think there will be some kind of world where you'll just upload your book to, you know, iTunes and that'll be it. And you'll advertise and try and get on the radio. It just is not, you know, if you are, you know, currently have written Harry Potter, you can do that with eBooks. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, she was very unique because she published these books before anyone knew that ebooks could be a big financial affair. Mm-hmm. And no one in the future, no publisher in the future is ever going to make that mistake again.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know. I don't actually see the business changing that much, except that, you know, vastly more of sales will be on ebooks. And I think that's going to change access, and that's also going to change, you know, I don't know. To me, in my own experience, I just buy a lot of more nonfiction now that I have a Kindle. You know, I just buy, you know, if I see a book that I'm even mildly interested in, I just buy it. You know, it's $10.
Why has that shifted you toward nonfiction?
Well, it, you know, it just is because I can skim it. If I don't like it, it's not a big loss.
Yeah.
Whereas before, if you would go and buy, you know, a $40 hardcover history of the War of 1812 and it was unreadable, it was a bummer, you know, it was a serious loss. Whereas I just sort of feel like now, you know, the price to get in is so low that I just, if I see a book that I'm interested in, I just buy it.
Well, when you think back a couple of years ago when you wrote that article and how you thought the future of e-readers was going to unfold, did you get anything wrong, or have you been surprised in the last 2 years or maybe in the last 6 months of some developments that have changed where you think we're going from here?
Well, I think I did think that Kindle was going to own the market completely. Mm-hmm. I just thought that the Kindle 2 was so far ahead of everyone else. I just thought that they were untouchable, and that that all the developments were going to come through them. I don't really feel that anymore. I don't know. You know, what I was worried about when I wrote that piece or afterwards is, you know, the iPad came out and everyone was like, "Oh, the iPad's just going to replace the Kindle and everyone will do that." And it hasn't.
Right.
And I was worried about that, but I guess I was right about that. I don't really think I did make a big mistake in that one in my life.
The only thing I think you might have hoped the term trans book would catch on, but it never did.
No, I guess e-reader, well, people just call it brand name. You know, it's now the Nook or Kindle or Kobo or whatever. But the you know, I guess the iPad, which I own, but I really don't like, you know, hasn't replaced anything.
Yeah, no, it's just been an alternate platform. Pretty good for the New Yorker and things, but even the New Yorker, I'd rather read a long piece in the New Yorker on my Kindle than on my iPad.
Well, I think the iPad is for TV. I mean, to me, that's what it's for. It's for watching TV while you're watching TV. You know, it's like you have sports on and you check your email and then watch a Seinfeld while you're watching the baseball game.
That's right.
You know, whereas a Kindle is an experience for reading, and that's a pretty vital distinction, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anything else that we haven't talked about that you've been watching and noticing as this drama unfolds?
No, I mean, I think a leap is going to come. I mean, I think someone is going to come out with one that is so far ahead of the other. Like, there is still such a long way to go here with the product that, you know, I think it is going to be really exciting when there's a real generational shift. And it is going to happen.
Terrific. I've been speaking with Stephen Marsh, a columnist for Esquire magazine and the author of How Shakespeare Changed Everything, available on Kindles everywhere. Thanks very much, Stephen.
Thanks, Len.
In content, I want to point you to something I first saw in Kip Poe's blog, and Amazon has formalized the procedure for submitting content for a Kindle single. You know, those are the items which are longer than a magazine article, shorter than a novel. And now there's a link that you can send to, and you're supposed to hear back within 2 weeks if your proposal is going to be accepted. Now, I think this is a pretty good opportunity because it's, you know, there's, of course, you can use Kindle Direct Publishing to get content into the Kindle store, but there's so much of that that it's, you've got to do your own work of getting it noticed. Kindle singles have their own section of the Kindle store, so they're much more visible. And if you have something that's strong enough to be considered, I think it'd definitely be worth checking out. That's all the time for this week. I think I have an interview set up through Amazon with Dave Limp, who was the vice president quoted in the announcement of the Kindle textbook rentals. So hopefully I'll have that for you next week when I put the show together from Ocean Park. This is Len Edgerly from Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.